Good morning, Mr. and Mrs. Redfield. It's so nice of you to have me here today. My name is Rita Durant, and I'm very pleased that you would allow me to come and speak with you this morning. I'm from the New York Historical Society, and this is the 2nd of April, 1987, and it's very brisk and cold out today. I understand that Mr. Redfield was born in this area. Is that right?
My husband, yes, was born in France.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah.
And where in France? Where did he go?
I have his birth certificate, but I don't know that I know the name of the place. Pop Redfield was in France studying and married Laurie's mother during the year she was over there. And they came back to this country and lived with Pop Redfield's parents. His father had a greenhouse in Glensall. And they had a little daughter, Elizabeth. And when she was 3 years old, she was killed by a barn door. And I guess it's difficult that under any circumstances to live with in-laws. But with a language barrier, it must have been very, very hard for Mother Redfield.
So then Mother Redfield was really French. She's not an American student.
No,
studying there. She was French.
French. It was at her family's hotel that Pop stayed.
Do you remember her name? Do you know what her name was?
Yes, Elise Delagant.
Delagant?
D-E-L-E-G-A-N-T.
Oh, right. Elise. Glove. Right.
And after the child was killed, Mother Redfield had an emotional breakdown, and Pop took her back to be with her people for a while, and it was during that period that Lauren was born. And you had to register the birth in 24 hours, and Mother Redfield's sister was named Lawrence, so they were going to name him Lawrence, and Pop rode a bicycle, I think 12 miles, to register the birth. And when he got there, they said, "You can't name a boy Lawrence, that's a girl's name."
Oh,
well, he didn't think it was worth riding back to consult with Mother Redfield about what they should name, and he said, "Give me the nearest thing he has to it." So it turned out to be L-A-U-R-D-N-T, and they called it the Red. And our grandson is named for him, and he is called the Red. And Mother and Pop Redfield both used the French pronunciation and called him Laurent.
Very, very special. I love French names.
Yeah.
That is a beautiful name.
I think it's so much prettier than the Lawrence that they aimed for.
Right, I should say. And so, how old was Lawrence then when he came back to this country?
He was just 5 months old when they came back.
Oh, so young.
Yeah. But they went back and forth after that all the time. They had 5 children, not other than Laurie. 5, including Laurie, but not including Elizabeth, who had died.
And what was the what was Lawrence's position?
Laurie was the oldest.
The oldest.
Yes,
after the little girl
who died.
I see.
And the next one was Horace, who was about a year younger, and Louise, who was Louise Stevens, and lived on the property of Pop Redfield, the old property, not the new. And then there was George and Francis. I think Martin Horace was George Francis.
I think you can.
And Lauren and his brother Horace apparently were pretty mischievous little boys. They used to get into all kinds of difficulties. And I know one time their father was painting, not one of his paintings, but painting something on the property. And Laurie and his brother reached up and pulled the can of paint all over themselves, all over the floor. Pop Redfield wasn't too happy about it. They weren't too happy about his attitude, so they crawled under the house, and it sloped up, you know, so it got more and more narrow. So they got back where Pop couldn't get at them until he cooled down a little bit, and they ventured out. Is that right, huh?
Yeah, it sounds like Huckleberry Finn and Tom Sawyer, their adventures, living right on the river, and two mischievous little boys. They must have had some good times. Did they ever play on the river?
It seems like such a dangerous spot.
Their home was between the river and the canal, and the second floor was on the canal level, so that each spring and fall the water would come into their home. And once they even left from boats from the second story window.
The river came up at that time. And that was early. That wasn't the flood of 55.
No.
Is that the time? So that it would go on the rampage like that, and people would be flooded out.
Twice a year, didn't it? The river would freshen in the spring and in the fall. What, darling? Yes. Sometimes it would barely come in, and sometimes it would, and all of the mess in there. And how people could, you know, go back to living there, but they wouldn't think of leaving the river.
I understand once you live on the river, there's just no other place in the world to be. People who live there love it and always return. They say it's worth it, evidently, because it's so beautiful.
Did you ever hear of Dr. Bell?
Yes, I have.
Well, his property was just a little bit on the river road, a little bit up from Redfield, and he apparently was rather eccentric and equipped his home against burglary, and I think he was killed inadvertently by one of the guns that went off.
And even today, we live so very few Peter's Corners. Even today, we sometimes forget to lock our doors. We never have a worry. No one ever comes to our doors anyway. It seems like the last safe place in the world to live, but I know that it isn't. But we just have that safe feeling. I imagine it was a beautiful place to grow up. I imagine, you know, to be a child and to be almost fearless of the at the environment or from outside danger.
But you probably had other dangers, I mean, like the river flooding, that life seems to compensate somewhat.
Yes, ever since law of compensation, I guess it's called. Yes, I can remember the terrible contagious diseases that we had in those days. The problems we had with impure water. We think today that we have environmental problems. I think the environmental problems years ago were really quite serious.
I just finished reading The City of Joy, and the lack of sanitation there is excellent.
What city does it have? Is it in
Calcutta?
Oh. Upton Sinclair also made this museum for a book called The Jungle, which is about the city of Chicago. And gives you the same kind of shock. Here we are, like 80 years later, and it is almost the same conditions that exist today. So it makes you feel like things can be done and will be done, progress will be made. But if there was any ideal place to live, it seems. The Newcomb area, and perhaps it was certainly Center Bridge, was a very lovely place to be. Now, his home was right near the bridge. It was what?
Walls.
The first home that he had was what? Between the, it was a sort of out.
Do you remember this little schoolhouse that's been made into a house?
Yes.
Well, their lane going into their home. And they shared it right in front of that. And then there was one of the canal bridges that they had to go over to get into their properties.
Were they camelback bridges in those days? They have such a charm about the little camelback bridges. But did they exist in those days, do you think?
Well, the
bridges over the canals.
Yeah.
You know, they had a sort of...
The rabbit run bridge, it was like that.
Yes, okay. That's what I mean. They're like that pretty much all the way down. I wonder if they were built at the same time. Then there was a little schoolhouse there?
On the left of River Road, there was a schoolhouse.
And is that where Laurent went to school?
Yeah.
Oh, wow. Is she talking about going to school?
I don't believe that.
But he did.
They went there a few years, and then they had to go to Solbury.
Yes.
For their later school. I think that possibly went up to eighth grade.
Oh, yes. Those were, in those days, however, you went to school on dirt roads.
Oh, they walked miles.
And they walked.
Yeah. But there was traffic.
Yes, that's true. And the Solbury School, the one that exists, it's still standing, I believe, and they've added to it at this point. That's really quite a long school, isn't it? It's been there for some time.
Well, that is not the one he went to. The one, the Solbury School you went to, was right on the road from Center Bridge. It was just a little schoolhouse right on the road.
Was that shaped in the round? It was not, because there was a school at Tri-Corner there that was shaped in the round.
That's in Newhope.
No, it was coming up from, I'm sorry, that was coming up from Lumberville. I'm just a little confused. That was coming up from Lumberville on Greenhill. So we went to the road. That was a tremendous hill to climb, isn't it? Yeah. You had to go up the hill, that huge hill. That easy to get down. Not so easy to get up.
They led down that road, and I guess it was a little bit dangerous where it crossed the river road, but of course it wasn't so much traffic in those days. But it was very, very dangerous because you would get going so fast, and it was rather risky. Playtime thing to do.
And how did you ever get there's a bend in the road there right at the bottom. How did you ever get the sled to turn at the very last minute? It must have been going awfully fast.
I guess you'd use your feet and your hands and jerk the top over.
Pretty dangerous if you didn't know how to turn a sled. Because there was quite a jerk in that road, if I remember correctly. But then, when did you meet Lauren then? Were you a local?
I lived in Doylestown.
Oh, you did?
Yes.
And you made names
with him? My father was Dr. Hayden, and he had a little private hospital on State Street.
Oh, goodness. And how did you meet him?
Larry says he always met his wife when he was hunting for a skunk. He and his brother did a great deal of trapping, and my father was a great nature lover, and in driving around the country, he saw these two boys with skunks, and he stopped to talk to them, and was very interested in them, and at that time, he had a garage business on the side. He always had a dozen irons in the fire, and he used to have to drive in the cars from Detroit, and he asked these two boys if they would be interested in driving in cars from Detroit.
Oh, you would have to, well, the cars would be made in Detroit, and then you would have to drive them from Detroit to the coast. See, there was no such thing as freight on board in those days.
To do it, yeah. And it was in that way that we met. So he always said he was out skunk hunting when he met his wife.
Oh, I love that.
I think that's his favorite story, too.
Well, did you drive then? Did he drive then?
Yes, he and Horace drove a number of times. But, did you take the train to Detroit, or how'd you get to Detroit? Hello? Did the train from Lansing? Okay.
He must have had to change train. Yeah, to Detroit instead. Yes.
Started from Lansdale.
What a harrowing experience that must have been, bringing the cars over the mountains to Doylestown, because there are lots of mountains.
Are the road?
Yes, we drive that now back to the Middle West. And there's some pretty high mountains before you get to Doylestown.
I think it was Rio's that they drove.
Oh, really?
From Detroit. Then later we drove Chevrolets from Tarrytown, New York. And I would frequently go, and Matty Lewis, who later married his brother Horace, and my sister. And once we took the boat from New York City up to Tarrytown.
Oh, how lovely.
And then drove the cars down.
What a beautiful trip that must have been. How were the roads in those days?
Well, you didn't know any other roads, so you just accepted what there was.
I have some rather misty remembrances of those lovely automobile trips. You know, when you would, I can remember my father who would scold mother and say, keep the side curtains down, you know. Put the side curtains down, and we would be freezing. We'd be so cold in the car. But of course, we thought we were just the most privileged people in the world because we had none. We weren't in the house already.
Oh, when Larry's father bought his first car, in those days, you just went to a garage and bought a car, and they told you how to crank it and how to steer it and turn you loose.
That's right.
And one of the first trips, or the early trip that Pop Redfield made with his family was to Easton. And I think the reason they went that far was because he didn't know how to turn around.
How did he go? Did he go along the river?
On the river.
On the river road. That's such
when
a scary
he got
ride.
To the center of Easton, a traffic policeman stood there with his arms out, and Pop kept right on going. And he finally drove into a public garage, and the only way he could stop was to drive up against the back of the garage.
And when he wasn't going very fast.
The policeman finally caught up with him. He said, why didn't you stop when I had my arms out? And Pop said, well, the car didn't stop. The horse always used to stop.
Oh, I love that story. That's wonderful. Did he finally find the break? I hope.
I hope.
Oh, dear. We were such innocents in those days. We had no idea what was ahead in the next 50 years, did we?
No.
Goodness. In fact, I think that it took, from the Model T, I think it was the Model T, it took 50 years for us to walk on the moon. We were doing pretty good as far as progress, mechanical progress was concerned. It was a great time to be alive, and all kinds of wonderful things were happening in our society.
Yes, and things that are like so wonderful that are were planned for advancement and now are used for destruction are rather serious, I think.
Very serious, yes. But of course, you know I'm involved with the voters of the Transcend, but the kind of legislation passed that we need to make things work. There's a saying, if the people will lead, the leaders will follow. And I like that. You know, it makes me feel like what I do as an individual is important. And we can philosophize a lot, and we can be distressed, but you still have to
do what one vote going to do. And they go, we have friends that really, I can't believe that they would think that way. They don't bother to vote. So it's like, we also think so all cut and dry, one vote won't make any difference.
It absolutely does. I remember that once the superintendent of schools lived across the street from us, and he said, read up, John, if you voted yet today. It was a school board issue. It was voting in a new school. And we said, we haven't, because we were busy on a Saturday. And he said, oh, we must get over and vote. The issue was passed by one vote. I said, that was when our vote passed. The new school, and it was a beautiful new school, and functioned for many years in our area. But we feel like it was our added vote,
yes,
that made,
yes,
it go, you know, and that's when we really felt our worth as voters. But I think you have to be active and make your feelings known. I think the messages finally get around if you. In some way, let the world know how to feel. I write, so yeah, that helps. What I feel, I multiply by writing about it. And so that makes me feel like it's really too bad what has happened today. And I think that what has happened today in our health picture as well has made us realize that we have to go back. We have to go back to square one. Yeah. And I think the immorality that we have seen progress in our society today has been just outrageous.
And the situation we're in with AIDS is pretty terrifying.
Yeah.
It must be very, very difficult for young people.
We grew up in such an innocent age, and you know, I'm programmed to think the way, of course, I was taught to think as a child. I think as a parent and a grandparent, it's hard to see what's going on today. I think people devalue themselves so easily. And this is a devaluing situation for individuals. I think the present day morality is, and I think the Lord has looked down on us and said, enough, I've had enough. Everybody has to shut up. I hope that's what's going on.
I hope so too.
I've heard many people say we have to go back to Victorian morality, and I said, good. I'm glad to hear
but
that.
I'm afraid that Victorian morality wasn't what we think it was. I think the things were just kept under cover.
Oh, yes, I'm sure that's true. But I think there were certain expectations of young people that they dared not follow.
And if we spoke to other young women our age, our ages as we were growing up, they were always bound by the same code. It was not only that they feared what would happen to them biologically if they were wild or they did something they shouldn't. They also feared father. They also feared what father would say and how disappointed mother would be and how they would dishonor their families. And this was what I call the Victorian ethic. We didn't want to disappoint our parents.
But when you think of the way royalty and even a lot of our public figures lived in that era, it wasn't anything to be very proud of.
No, that's true. But then, we could always take private instances, and there are many of them. There's so many of them.
Well, of course, it's only the bad things publicized.
Exactly. I think that if we could count the number of women who were true to their marriages and true to their husbands and husbands true to their wives, we'd run out of numbers.
We'll have 62 years together this summer.
Good for you. You're 20 years ahead of me. That's wonderful. 62 years. My goodness. And what day this summer?
27th.
Well, congratulations. Thanks. I'm really moved to think the two people who lived together for so long and so with such obvious happiness. And I think it's just a little bit. So then you were married in 25.
That's right.
And you must have been terribly young.
No, I mean, I was 23. I was born in 1901. I was married in July, and I was 24 in another month.
And what day were you born July?
What day? In August, I was
born. Oh, I'm sorry.
August 27th, 14 a month.
Oh, okay. And how about...
He was born December 12th, 1899.
Oh, goodness.
So he's the same age as the year, except from December 12th to the 1st of the year.
Goodness, that's 162 years. That is really thrilling. Does the world know about this? We should be applauded. I think it's wonderful.
Well, I think we need any applause. Laurie has been absolutely perfect to live with. He just is so kind and so unselfish, and since he has been sick, he is so appreciative that nothing is a chore to do for him. He just is loving and cooperative and
has loved him too. And has he always been like that? He's always had that kind of personality.
That's the only side of him I saw. Now, he was in the lawnmower business, and his customers saw a different side. But he loved motors, and if they didn't put oil in their motors, he would tell them about it. Our daughter thinks it's absolutely abnormal, but we have never had an argument. We've never had a fight. A lot of the basic things of life we do not agree on, but we don't try to change each other. I mean, I have my ideas, and I know he could change them. I feel the same way about his ideas. They're his privilege.
Helpful. Both of them that you found each other.
I really think it was whoever found Laurie that got the bargain.
Aww. Isn't that nice? No. See, he's not going to say anything back, but I think he really wanted to. Well, I know what you mean, because that's the kind of husband I want to.
very easy thing to run up here as well. I'm spoiled, I think, to all of them.
I worked for my father. He had a private hospital, and I worked there for 40 years.
What did you do?
Everything.
Were you, did you take care of patients?
No, not. He had, it was a 12-bed private hospital. No. But after all, we're getting a little bit away from Pop Redfield.
Yes, I really wanted to find out about you. Because we know, I don't feel like we're getting away from anything.
Well, I worked there for 40 years, 7 days and 4 nights a week. Now, that was not all night, it was from Lois' office hours for evening. And Larry took care of our daughter. They would come up to the hospital for their meals, but he would take her home at night. And it was so unselfish that I never realized until after my father died that I had always put him first, which is completely wrong according to the Bible. And but Larry was so unselfish that he never indicated it in any way.
Do you think that this was something fortunate for you? And if you had one daughter,
yeah,
and her name was
Patricia.
Patricia. And Patricia is came along with
she was born in 1927.
And do you have grandchildren?
We have 3 grandchildren.
And do any of them have a talent for painting?
No.
How about Robert? Oh, Robert is not your grandchild.
He's our nephew.
I see. So that the artistic talent is really not, per se, has not been handed down.
But not as an artist, but there's one grandson that has designed sets for the theater, not Broadway, but the theaters of Connecticut, and they will write to him, and he will draw a set for them. So I think some of that must have been born in him. And we remodeled a barn when we were married, and Larry planned every inch of it. And
so he does.
I think that does take ability.
It certainly shows artistic artistic talent is there. But where did you live then when you were married? Did you live in Doorstown or did you live?
We lived right in the barn that we were
in. The barn that you
we never lived. And you could see it from every one of our windows. And I loved every inch of it. And that's in so much that I was really concerned from a religious standpoint, because you're not supposed to love material things like that. But every time I went upstairs or came downstairs, I'd give a little prayer of thanksgiving that we were privileged to live there.
I know what you're saying. I feel that way.
And yes, when Larry had his stroke, and it wasn't practical to stay there, that feeling left me. Yesterday, I took a woman to the bus stop for New York, which is right opposite our barn. I didn't even think of it as ever having been my home.
And where is this located again?
It's right.
You can see it from here? Really? You can see it from here? Well, it's messaging people, isn't it?
It really, I don't know how Laura feels, but it doesn't concern me at all.
And you raised your daughter there and lived there all these years. Oh, it's having a great time. Well, tell me, are there any other children in the family then that have had this artistic talent? I think you told me about Robert Stevens. Not in your family, but
I don't know of any other.
No, I mean the
except Bobby.
Bobby, and his name is Steven?
Steven.
What is his middle name?
They don't know.
Okay. I know another Robert Stevens who is just 4 years old, and I must tell him. I know another Robert Stevens.
Well, is he a photographer?
No, this is just a little boy. He started like my godchild. So I must tell Robert Stevens that I know another.
Well, Bobby's father lives in the old property.
He does.
Between the river and the
land. Oh, I must tell his daddy that. These people are really appreciate
Bob was the athletic director for Lincolnville Hospital for many, many years. They had a great big vacation when he retired. He loves children. He would love to see them.
I'll have to see if I can get my parents to bring Robert. His name is Robert Wesley Stevens. And I'll have to see if I can and introduce him to his name. So now, I really think I've just about exhausted the information that I should about you and your husband. Would you like to talk about it? You call him Pop Redfield. I know of him as Edward Redfield. And I fell in love with his paintings before I ever knew a thing about him. When I was a newcomer and I saw two of his paintings, which I would tell the public about at the program. There's one that is one painting on one wall above her organ that is called The Canal at Nevo. And there's another painting on the opposite wall, and it's called Spring on the Delaware. And they are just beautiful.
At Pearlbach.
At Pearlbach's home.
Yes, I have photographs of
it. Two of them?
Yeah.
Well, I was a volunteer out there, and I would show people through the home, and I would tell them as much as I knew about Edward Redfield, the painter. And I always felt that they were such special paintings.
They are going to be here. They're going to have an art festival, and our apartment will be open for a week, including both weekends.
Your apartment will be open?
From 1 to 4. Two evenings from 7 to 9.
Oh, that's very generous.
Well, it isn't generosity. It's joy of sharing the beautiful work. And then it is a little bit selfishness, because a painter can be forgotten if he isn't kept before the public.
I think I know what you're saying. I discussed this with Mr. Nye. I met George Nye. The people at the Pearlbach home were toying with the idea that they might publish these paintings in order to raise money for the elementary children, with your permission, of course. But they wanted to know what kind of money was involved, what the cost would be feasible, or if it would be and would give them money for their children. And they decided that it wouldn't. It's just,
well, there's a really big donation.
Yes, that's what we're talking about. But that's how I met George. And I was very, very impressed with him. Certainly, it gave me some really valuable information. It must have been very nice to deal with him when you had your breath stopped. He's very painstaking, isn't he?
Very.
About the colors and so forth.
But, of course, it wouldn't have been done if the colors were not accurate either. So, you know, we were both working toward the same end, right, which helped.
Right, I think it's important to have this, you know, important. This is George Knight of the Primrose Press. He was the man who did the first printings that you had done. I understand there's still some master prints available, is that true?
That's right.
At this
they
point,
call them proof prints.
Proof prints, yeah. I see.
And they are at the Framers Unlimited at 110 Doyle Street.
110 Doyle Street. Unlimited, and they're still available. I didn't know that at the time when I went to that. But I understand that you're considering doing this again.
Well, we have two that we hope will be out before the 1st of May.
So it's already in the works.
That handy one, the one I showed you in the bedroom.
This one?
Yes.
That's me. And then the one that you showed, the other one that you showed.
This one.
How are the other paintings? Are they pretty well sold out? The other paintings?
I think the one you have, the Legend Mirror, I believe, is all sold out. Now the other, the Robotnik Farm, is not a typical Redfield. Most people think of Pop Redfield doing only winter sleep. But of course that wasn't true, and I think it was very important to have a different type of his work, so people would realize he did other types of work. But it hasn't sold as rapidly. And he gave that painting to my parents when they bought a larger painting from him. I think he felt a little guilty and painted this and gave to them. So I think I had it done maybe for sentimental reasons, because it had meant so much to me, because Pop had given it to my parents.
Yeah. I just loved all the lovely mauves and golds and everything in that winter scene, and it was something I really noticed.
That's the one for which Pop got that gold medal over there.
Oh.
That was given by the Carnegie Institute of Art, and it is 15 ounces of, I think, 14 karat gold.
That's incredible.
And I think it is as good as anything he ever did.
We have a light over it, so I had it framed in that. The gentleman at the Panic Gallery said it was only, I have only double hands on it, and he does triple man. And it just looks so much prettier with triple man. And he said he would bring the colors in.
The is to have nothing that has any acid in that touches the print.
Well, the girl that did it in she says she does music. And she said that it would, the paper was of excellent quality and it would not change. So anyway, what I'd like to ask about Mr. Redfield's beginnings in the New Hope area. I understand that he came here, he was from closer to the
city. His folks lived in Glenside.
And how did he ever find New Hope? Do you have any idea why he came here? Well, he was in Satterbridge,
really. Just the beauty of the location, and he was hunting for a spot on which he could raise vegetables and chickens, and also from which he could paint. And so he first bought the island. Are you familiar with the island?
Yes.
Well, that was what he owned first. And then he bought the property across from it. And the painting that we have given to the James Michener Art Museum is painted from the front of that property.
Oh, I see.
And then this is still another property that he bought.
So pretty. Well, you want me to turn this off? Oh, he was pointing.
I think he's got the lights on this door.
No, it's something down there. I think they just slammed the door.
Okay.
Yeah, I was getting horses. Is Mr. Redfield? Oh, I thought he was getting tired. I just wondered how he discovered that he had this talent. Do you have any idea? Did he start as a child?
Well, I have just loads of books that tell a great deal about it.
Yeah. I didn't know they existed.
Well, not books. Well, for instance, this one was published by a friend of his, and Poppy used to give a copy to everyone who bought a painting.
It's called Redfield.
Very, very stingy about giving them out to the family.
Well, I can see. And he used to give them to people who bought a painting.
Yeah.
I bought a painting.
Yeah.
And the last publication, the first publication, it was the references. These are references. I'm just looking for publication date. Looks like the last.
Well, I think it
probably
was just
about 1919.
There was just one publication. This friend of his did it for him, Charles Wheeler.
Here's a publication date. Yes. Well, that really is a lovely thing to have. And it tells about how he started painting. This is the one. This is the big world of painting. Yes, it is. That I have shown that to more people. But you were saying that I was under the impression, rather, that when Mr. Redfield started, some of his paintings were just immediately started selling for really another handsome sums, and that would sustain him for a long time. That isn't true.
I wouldn't think that would be true.
There was a time.
Whether he was old, just a little boy, I think, 7 or 8 years old, in school, he drew a picture of a cow. And then that was the first thing that the family remembered his having any interest in drawing. And his father sent him to school. I really have never gone into his educational background because I would just give people the book to read, you know.
Sure.
But his father sent him to the Academy of Fine Arts and several art institutions, and then finally sent him abroad and gave him an allowance to study over there.
Yeah, and then as an active painter, he married a family. Was he still sustained then by his father?
He never had any income other than his painting.
Other than his
But Mother Redfield was French and frugal, and they had the garden, and they had chickens. And Larry doesn't like chicken or eggs to this day because that's all they had as children.
I know what you
said. Pop was a wonderful, wonderful garden. There was one incident of Larry and his brother having caught a pigeon, and they kept it in a little chicken house they had on the property and tamed it. And Pop Redfield didn't know the boys had it. And one day the pigeon got out, and Pop was working in the garden. And the pigeon landed on his shoulder as he was down on the boys. It's scary to have a bird on your shoulder, but
I thought he ended up a squab.
No.
With a French brother, she made a dinner out of it. She didn't know it was a pet.
I think the boys came to the rescue of the bird.
Oh, good. Yeah, and I understand that he would go out in any kind of weather.
Any kind of weather. Any painting he did. Any painting he did right on the spot. That fire and another one he did of the fire are the only two things that he ever did other than standing and watching the spot that he was painting. And he couldn't do that because the fire was at night. Now, all of this is on the tape that I have that shows the tours I used to give when we lived in the barn.
And did he do this hanging too
as
well? Yes, he did. Tapestry.
Well,
they were hook rods. And so that's his design, and he actually put them in.
That's right. And he made furniture. He made that Windsor chair and that Windsor chair, and he made an absolutely magnificent drop-in table, an 8-leg black worn drop-in table that I was heartbroken that we couldn't have here, but it was so heavy and massive that it overpowered the other things. Oh, our daughter has. Yeah.
It has to go to someone who really know what they have.
And he would stain the wood in a tea kettle until he could bend it to the shape he wanted.
He
was the kind of person that was versed in every angle of life. He knew literature, he knew baseball, he knew woodworking, he knew gardening, of course he knew painting.
He certainly did. It was like that. Because he was so good at so many things. It was just, he was the kind of person once in a century. I think he's such a genius without even knowing. Because he's so good at so many things. It's just amazing. Every day, and he would, I understand he would come in sometimes with his hands just about frozen.
Well, Mother Redfield knitted him
special things.
Right. The fingers were theirs, but the wrists were kind of made.
So that the fingers were out, but the wrist.
In some of the weather in which he painted, he would have to tie the easel to the tray and canvas to the easel.
Oh. And I imagine he was, couldn't even protect it from the weather. I mean, if there's snow, and which would start raining, the easel was painted. They're out in the wilderness, out in the rain or the snow, or the wind, or whatever might affect it. Oils take a long time to dry.
Well,
they
put them, depending on something like that. It was maybe weeks in the studio or even months.
Were the people waiting for you? Was it hard to sell
things? You see, that was a little bit before my time, and I don't think the children were conscious of that angle of life. People would come into the studio, but the children were, you know, like little wild animals. And one time Laurie and Horace hid in a sideboard because they didn't want to meet whoever came in. And the people stayed for hours, and these two kids were trapped in the sideboard, and another time there were people there looking at the paintings, and Laurie and his brother had come across a skunk, and they had this stick that was
very evidently near a skunk, and they brought it into the house to prove that they had seen the skunk.
Well, tell me, how about Mrs. Redfield? Was she?
Mother Redfield was French, and I guess abroad the husband was first in everything. And that is all she lived for, was Tom Redfield. And his meals were on the stroke of 12 and on the stroke of 7. If we were out somewhere and got home at 5 minutes of 6, it seems to me she could have dinner on the table at 6 o'clock.
Amazing. So, and she was, then, of course, probably just as devoted as a mother. Mother to the college.
I don't have the feeling she was. I don't know how the children felt. And a friend of mine who thought she was going to write a book on E.W. Redfield looked up a lot of things in the archives in Washington, and she said that Tom got more medals than any artist, any American artist except Sargent. And she found a great many of his letters which indicated that he was awfully interested in his children whenever he would go anywhere, if he would see an unusual toy or something, if he could afford it, he would bring it home. And Pop Redfield was the most realistic, down-to-earth person that you could ever imagine, and yet he had whatever that power is that gives you to see events that are going to happen. And he never acknowledged having that, or very seldom mentioned it. The only thing I know about it is that he was at the Philadelphia Art Club at dinner one night, and he had this feeling he should get home. He got up and left in the middle of dinner and got to Glenside, and the house was on fire. And if he hadn't gotten there, the family would have burned him.
Oh. So he really had a bunch of things inside
him.
It was a sensitivity that was beyond normal sensitivity. I mean, what you and I
intend. I think it went even beyond that, because I don't think either of us would have anything that would make us leave in the middle of a dinner to get
home. Oh, no, I believe that, yes. They say that, that mothers might have certain feelings about their children, but it's just really sort of an educated guess, really. It's more, it's really not intuition, it's just. It's just exposure and caring that makes us know when our child is sensitive to temperature in the middle of the night, or when they're uncovered or something like that, or when they're not feeling well. But I think this kind of an event goes way beyond
all
that. That's a psychic. That's a psychic experience,
yes.
Really. And I think that for a great creative mind like that, this is just one of the dimensions of that experience. Do you know of any other experiences in my life?
As I said, he didn't make any.
He was very modest.
Any issue. Well, I don't think it was modesty as much as the fact that I think maybe he might have been a little ashamed of having that. I really have no idea his feelings.
I think that I think that those who are so gifted sometimes are fairly charlatans and more sensible people to be honest with them. But I thoroughly believe that I'm absolutely aware of this is That's really wonderful. Have they saved his whole family? Were they all asleep in the house at the time?
Yeah.
Oh. And he got where was the phone at the time?
In Glenside.
Oh, this was in Glenside. Oh, this was his parents. We're never aware that it expressed itself.
He never.
He was not talking about that. How about the other community of artists that we now call the Newton School? Was he active in that with Dr. Redker, Mr. Garber, Walter Lee Farr?
All the good friends. And they used to have a big picnic at Hot Redfield's place. I know Mother Redfield would one time, I think they had a goat that climbed up on the roof of the house. Oh, 4th of July, I think they would have a big picnic. Mother Redfield would make a miraculous strawberry ice cream. And all that group of artists would be there with their families, and they all grew up close. But Pop was not the type to make an issue of things. Now, Mr. Major was much more social. He would have afternoon teas, and they had big New Year's Eve parties. Angle was not that, it was just friendship.
It was more family associated with children. And Mr. Garber was one of his principals.
Yes, I think Mr. Garber was one of his principals. Yeah. Pop was the first one to be in the But I don't think he ever made any issue of the fact that Mr. Redford was the one that was usually called up as big first there, because Mr. Redford was the type that, you know, went into that sort of thing.
He just more or less advertised his presence up more.
Well, I don't know that you would all of exactly advertising, but he was much more social. He would have people in, as I say, the tea every afternoon. Mrs. Lake would serve afternoon tea. I think she was English.
Oh, yes. That's true. Yeah. See all their works today now sometimes displayed at the antique shows at the New York Historical Society does.
You mean Mr. Garber?
We have one painting we think might be Mr. Garber's painting of Mr. Lathan. Or it might be Mr. Lathan's painting of Mr. Garber. We're not sure which it is.
We would
love to show it to you.
There's one painting that Garber did a painting that I think is the most magnificent thing I've ever seen. And that was in that show that was about 2 or 3 years ago that started in Allentown at the Allentown Art Museum. And it was put on by Tom Folk, who got his master's degree in art on Pop Redfield. Now he's got his doctorate on all the beautiful.
And is he from Allentown?
No, he lives in Fredericksburg, New Jersey.
And it's wonderful that you do that.
I'm afraid that at this point, I ran out of questions, and I could see that Mr. Redfield was getting tired. and I certainly was getting tired. And so we decided to call a halt and have some lunch. Mr. and Mrs. Redfield went in to have their lunch, and I went into the family room. Of course, they insisted that I have lunch with them, but I didn't. I went into the family room and had a glass of orange juice and some yogurt that Mrs. Redfield brought me, and that was my lunch. It was lovely to spend a half an hour with all those lovely Redfield paintings all to myself. There was one of Mrs. Edward Redfield. She was a beautiful lady with very short cut white hair and blue eyes. She was dressed in a blue and white striped dress and a blue sweater. And so she was a study in blue and white, much like Blue Boy. And it's a very interesting portrait of Mr. Edward Redfield's French wife. After lunch, Mr. Laurent Redfield went in to have his nap, and Mrs. Redfield and I talked again. She was the most gracious lady, and Mr. Redfield, too, was, although he had very little to say, was extremely kind and very, very good to me. I can't imagine two people more loving and sweet than the Redfields. This was truly an exceptional experience in my life, and one I wouldn't have missed for anything.